Okay, I guess we should get started. So today's the last lecture in the programming lecture series and the whole course. So we'll cover some material we haven't covered that's kind of interesting and fun on programming with constraints. We'll also start off by explaining, describing some sort of useful extra material to know about the capability to define infix operations of your own in Prolog and ways you can use that to maybe make the syntax of your program a little bit more readable. So then I'll go into explaining what constraint programming and constraint logic programming are and give several examples using something called finite domain constraints and then a couple of smaller examples of other constraint domains. And at the end, I'll kind of give an overview of review of the course material relating to programming that you need to make sure you know for the exam. Okay, so to start out, as we've seen already, Prolog has many infix operators built in. So we've seen, you know, arithmetic operations like addition and subtraction and so on. And unification equality is a binary infix operator. Is or evaluation is also. And this univ operator that we saw last programming lecture. But you can also define your own infix operators or prefix or postfix operators. So this really just means extending the syntax of the language so that when the parser encounters one of your own user-defined infix operators, it will parse it as a term and turn it into an internal representation that's just the same as if you'd written it as a function symbol applied to some arguments. So let me just explain what I mean by that. So for example, we can write x is equals y plus z. So we've seen this already. And if we display y plus z, then we see that internally the term is represented as just addition applied to some variables. So in this file here, I've declared my own infix operator symbol called 2 carats for exponentiation. So since I've got that declared in this file, this declaration means that also I can use this exponentiation operator as an infix operation. So if I say display x to the power n, that will do the same thing as if roughly the same thing as with addition. But this symbol is something that I came up with myself. It isn't something that the Prolog parser knew about in advance. So let me go into the form of declarations that this allows. So basically, this colon dash op declaration is something that can appear in an external source file. And basically, it takes 3 arguments. The first argument is something called a precedent specification. So this says, is a number that tells you how this operation relates to other operations if there's ambiguity in parsing. So for example, things that bind tighter, I think like multiplication, have higher precedence than things that bind more loosely like addition. Or maybe the reverse. Let me just look at the examples on the next slide to make sure I've got it right. Yeah, so. I think I've got it the other way around. So things that bind more tightly have lower precedence numbers, and things that bind more loosely, like implication or disjunction, have higher precedence numbers. Okay, so basically that's a number you can adjust it to put the operation into the right order with respect to other operations. And the second argument is something called a fixity specification. And that's just a string or an atom that is of one of the following forms. You can have operations like equality that take 2 arguments which are kind of mnemonically written x, that kind of says that you have 2 arguments that don't have any, you're never going to say, never going to have any syntactic ambiguity of the form. You know, you'll never write x equals y equals z, or at least Prolog doesn't let you write this, because x, this is kind of there's no left or right associativity for very well might write a chain of additions as x plus y plus z, and in that case you need the other two fixity specifications to describe whether you want left associative behavior, that is, for this expression to be parsed as x plus y first, then plus z, or right associative, that is, you want it to be parsed as x plus y plus z. And for addition, of course, it doesn't matter semantically, but for some operations like subtraction and so on, it does matter, so you need to say which one you mean. And so you can also define unary operators that go before and before an expression or after an expression. So for example, prolog negation, the backslash plus operator, is an example of a prefix operation. So, and then finally, the last argument is either an atom or a list of atoms, and that says what things are being declared as operators. Okay? Great. So just to emphasize, you know, the power of this, infix operator or user-defined operator specifications, the system internally actually just uses this mechanism to define the existing built-in operators. So they're not really built-in in some sense. They're specified using the a generic facility in the language itself. So for example, things like implication or the definite clause grammar arrow have a very low precedence, so they have a high precedence number, and they're neither right nor left associative. And then you have things like disjunction, semicolon, or conjunction, comma, and then higher and higher precedence things like equality or integer arithmetic. And then, of course, you have unary variations of the integer operations, okay? So now just to illustrate one thing you can do with this, you might remember from a tutorial we had an exercise where you wrote where we needed to define the exponential operation on integers. Now let's say we want to add the ability to write exponentiation inside expressions along with other prolog integer operations like addition and so on. So we can do that by, unfortunately, we can't extend the behavior of the is predicate because that's hardwired, but we can define our own evaluation predicate that supports both the arithmetic operations that the is predicate supports and also this new operation, this exponentiation, right? So here, for example, I've said, okay, if you have an expression that's written using our user-defined exponentiation operation, then evaluate both of the subterms and then use this power predicate that I've defined here to construct the result. So for example, if I say 2 to the 3 to the 4, that's going to be, first of all, that's going to be parenthesized as 2 to the 3 to the 4. And so that's going to be something pretty big, right? Whereas if we write 2 to the 3 to the 4, that's just going to be 8 to the 4, which is not that big, right? And furthermore, since I've included addition in this, I can use that in the terms as well. So, okay. So that's just to illustrate. This is sometimes a handy feature. Okay. So now a related note connected to this, which you might remember in the fourth or fifth lecture, we discussed that Prolog supports arithmetic, but it's sort of not as logical as the other parts of the language. So for example, we can write, okay, 2 plus 2 equals 4, but that, you know, since plus is uninterpreted, the interpreter will come back and say, well, no, they're not equal because they're not literally the same term, so, which is kind of irritating. But we can say, okay, well, take this term and evaluate it. As I just gave examples on the previous slide, or in the previous code example, we can say, okay, evaluate this term and then bind it to whatever this is. And so then we can, you know, we get access to the built-in arithmetic operations on the machine. But this isn't, you know, A isn't logical in the sense that it's not really equality, right? You can't say, even though you can say x is 1 plus 2, you can't say 1 plus 2 is x, because this term is expected to be a ground term that you can evaluate, and this can be anything, so you get an instantiation error. And also for this reason, you know, the placement of these is operations in the expression matters, so you need to make sure that you don't call is before the right-hand side is bound to something ground at runtime. So that is kind of irritating. So there are some more problems with this besides, so I've just talked about the order of evaluation problem, but there's also a problem that if we can only sort of compute arithmetic modulo arithmetic on ground terms, then there are times when we might need to come up with, you know, a specific value that increases the branching factor of the search for a solution to a problem unnecessarily. So you might not need to know that something is 5, just that it's greater than 0 for the time being. So I'm going to give examples of this in case it's not clear the point here. But right, so here's an example. So for some search problems, we've seen examples, you know, you want to sort of specify the search space first and then specify what the solution to the problem looks like, and then just kind of either try all possibilities or maybe try and resolve, figure out what kinds of things can look like solutions first. So here, here's a useful predicate for sort of delimiting a search space. So we just have a predicate that says, okay, a number is between a low value and a high value in the following cases. So either it is the low value, or the low value is less than the high value, and it's between the next largest thing and the high value. Okay. So this is a predicate that if you call it on, if you call it say on 1 and 1,000, then without giving any constraint here, it's just going to come back 1,000 times and count from 1 to 1,000. And if you do give it a constraint, then it will try the first 999 solutions before it finds a solution that says, it's, you know, the answer is 1,000. And, you know, so in addition to the possibly high branching factor and expensiveness of that search, we also have the problem that we can't rearrange this comparison constraint and try and solve it, or at least keep it in mind before we solve the betweenness constraint, because at this point, n won't be bound to a number. Okay, so let me just illustrate this with a larger larger number. So this is, you know, noticeably taking some time to count to it should be 999999, but right, so it eventually finds the solution, but there's a noticeable delay while it's searching for all the stupid answers that don't satisfy the inequality, okay? And then if I tried this second one, we would just get an instantiation error right away. So that's bad. So what can we do to do a better job of these kinds of problems? Well, what we'd like to do is just kind of say things that look like equations that maybe have free variables in them, and maybe collect the equations up, and then once we have enough to believe that there's going to be some unique solution, we can just hopefully just try and tell the system to solve for x or solve for x and y. Okay, so we might want to say, okay, x plus 1 is equal to 5 times y, and y is 1, so well, what can x be? Well, there has to be a unique example in this case because it's a linear equation, so you know, 5 times y is just 5, and x plus 1 then has to be 5, so x has to be 4. So there is actually a large amount of knowledge about how to solve systems of linear equations and inequations, which you might have seen in mathematics courses. And there's a lot of work on how to automate this, so how to take big systems of equations like these and solve them. So, for example, linear programming for real or real or rational arithmetic. So why don't we just use that? Well, that's also a powerful and declarative way to specify problems, but it's also kind of awkward to just you restrict yourself to, say, linear inequalities. So you have to kind of think maybe pretty hard about how to represent your problem in the very restrictive language of linear equations and inequations. So what would be nice is if we could maybe alternate between the, and so what that means in particular is if you have a problem that has some components that are describable by systems of equations and constraints, but the whole problem requires some additional search, or maybe searching a complicated search space like we've seen a couple of lectures ago, then you're kind of stuck. There's no way to represent the whole problem as a constraint program. So instead, what we'd like to do is to be able to mix constraint programming and ordinary logic programming to get a kind of more powerful formalism, and then essentially be able to write a logic program that builds a complicated set of constraints, and then once we think we have enough constraints to be able to find a solution, we can just push a button and use constraint programming to find answers. So that is a sort of extension to logic programming that's been explored quite a bit, called constraint logic programming. So I'm going to give some examples of how this works. So the basic idea is really you can sort of think of this as a generalization of what logic programming or what Prolog already does with unification. So you could think of unification problems as constraints and the solutions as being solved forms of those constraints. So, but in constraint logic programming, we can also have constraints involving other domains like integer or real arithmetic, or even sort of finite domain constraints or crazier things. So, what we're going to do is instead of the program state just being a set of where we are in the proof search space, and also a set of also a substitution saying how we've solved the unification problem so far, we extend the state to include extra special additional predicates called constraints. And so the idea is the program can generate constraints at any time just by writing them as goals. And whenever we encounter such a constraint, we're going to add it to the state, to the current constraint store, and maybe solve it a bit or solve it completely to make sure that we haven't encountered an unsatisfiable problem. So again, for example, if we just think of equations and unification as a constraint domain, then these unification goals are a form of constraint, and the constraint solving or reduction is just unification. Okay. So then if we ever detect that the collection of constraints has become inconsistent, then we stop and backtrack just like normal. And then we might also have some special predicates that we use at the end of the computation to look at the constraint domain and make sure it really is satisfiable and enumerate solutions. So we might have lots of different ways of trying to find solutions for the constraints once we're done. Okay. So, so here are some examples from a common constraint domain that's implemented, for example, in Sixtus called finite domain constraints. So let's look at three or four simple examples of finite domain constraints. So basically, this just means finite subsets of the natural numbers. You can map any other finite domain to that domain. So we'll have one constraint that basically replaces this between predicate that I showed before that says, okay, we have a number and it's in this interval I through j inclusive. So that means n has to have one of these finitely many values I through j. And we also have special equality constraints, and the difference between this hash equals and ordinary equals is just that instead of unifying, this hash equals is going to go into the constraint store and force whatever solution we eventually find is going to have to satisfy that this t is equal to this u considered as an arithmetic thing. And t and u can also involve addition and subtraction and so on. Similarly, we're going to have special constraint forms of the inequality less than, greater than, less than or equal, greater than equal operators. And so the important thing is that these predicates are going to constrain the solutions, but they're not going to generate values. And you don't have to provide ground values for them to work. right? So, yeah, so let me just do this example. So we can say, okay, instead of saying, using this explicit between predicate, we might say, just say n has to be in between 1 and a million, and also n has to be bigger than a million minus 1. And I used the wrong version of less than, so that didn't work. So in this case, I should get n is a million, but I got it right away instead of having to wait for a half a second. Okay, so similarly, I guess in this case, let's say I ask it to give me back something between 1 and a million, and also between 5 and 500,000, right? So in this case, basically, we have two interval constraints on n, and we're basically going to take the intersection and say, okay, well, in that case, n had better be between 5 and 5 million. Well, this interval is a subinterval of this interval, but I can also say, okay, is n between 2 and 5, and how can n also be between 3 and 7? Then I should get n has to be between 3 and 5, right? So we're just taking the intersection of these two sets of inequalities. Sorry, solving the two sets of inequalities and reducing them to a normal form. Okay? So now, another thing we can do is, once we've imposed enough constraints on the domain to think that there should be a solution, we can ask the system to go out and find some concrete values that solve the problem. So for example, if I say, for which values of x and y, such that x is between 1 and 5 and y is 2x plus 1, we can ask it to find values of y that make this true, right? So, well, x can be between 1 and 5, so there will probably be 5 different solutions, right? So we'll get, okay, well, x could be 1, and then we solve and get y equals 3, and so on. And we can also impose further constraints, maybe y, say y has to be bigger than 4. Okay, and then we'll just get 4 of these solutions. Okay. Now another way there's another predicate that we can use to generate values for more than one of the free variables of the constraint, and also to do a bunch of other things. So it's kind of a Swiss Army knife type predicate, but we'll only use it in a specific way. So this predicate is called labeling. So basically, this is going to come up with simultaneous solutions in maybe 2 or 3 or more variables. So the first argument is going to be a list of options, and for the time being, I'm not going to use any of the special options. I'm just going to pass in the empty list. And the second argument is a list of variables that are subject to constraints in the current state. And so this is going to then try to enumerate all solutions. And the options you can pass in give it different search strategies for enumerating the solutions. So if you don't pass any of these arguments, it'll just use whatever the default is. So we can say, okay, when is x between 0 and 3 and y between 0 and 3 and x is less than y, and then generate all the solutions. So, let's see what happened there. Oh, it should be n. Okay, so this is going to enumerate the solutions. Okay, So now, in addition to enumerating all possible solutions we can ask the system to find us assignments to the variables of the problem that minimize or maximize some function. So for example, we can say, okay, consider x between 1 and 100 and consider y, say y has to be equal to x minus 50 times x, so x squared minus 50x. Let's find the solution that minimizes the value of y such that, the solution that minimizes the value of y, that's all this is saying. The first subgoal here is saying how we should generate solutions, and the second subgoal is saying what we should evaluate to say what we want to minimize. So in that case, I've got the answer on there already, but let me just copy it over. So if I ask it to solve that, it should come back and say, right, so basically this is a parabola, right? And it's going to have, and it points upward, so it's going to have a least value somewhere. And in this case, the solution found is that x has to be 25, so we get x minus 25, which is negative 25 times x, which is 25, and so y is negative 625. And if you want to prove that's the minimum of the overall parabola, then you can do that in a calculus class, not here. Okay, so now there are some additional kinds of constraints that we can impose, such as inequality. So saying that two, whatever values x and y take, a solution has to have different values for x and y. Okay, so these are, again, and so this is really where the ability to not commit to values for x and y before we say that they have to be not equal comes into force, is that, if we were trying to solve a problem with lots of inequality constraints in a normal setting, then this would impose a large combinatorial explosion because there are, you know, maybe order n squared possible values for x and y that are different if x and y can have independent values, okay? So in addition, we can impose distinctness constraints on sets of variables. So we can say, here's a list of variables and they all have to have different values at the end in a solution. And this is really just shorthand for x1 different from x2 and x1 different from x3 and so on. So this really unfolds to a triangle of inequality constraints. Okay? Great. So now here's an example. So there are a couple, there are several kinds of problems that you can solve using these kinds of constraints that are not as easy to solve using the sort of traditional generate and test style of search in Prolog. So one example is something like a Sudoku puzzle, which you've probably all seen. I didn't want to do that because that actually has a lot of bureaucracy involved. But here's a simpler type of puzzle that also illustrates the benefits of doing this. So the idea is we have an equation that's specified in terms of letters, which are really variables that we can fill in with any number between 0 and 9. Okay, and so this is maybe apropos today because of the demonstration. This is called a cryptarithmetic puzzle, and in this case, the puzzle says find numbers to fill in for S, E, N, D, M, O, R, and Y, such that send plus more adds up to money. Right? Okay. So, So how can we do this in kind of traditional classic Prolog by generating and testing? Okay, well let me just walk through this. So we can define a predicate that solves the problem and sort of fills in the answers into lists so that you can sort of see what the solution looks like right away. And the way this is going to work is we're going to say, okay, first we'll constrain, or first we'll generate values for S, E, and D, and all the other letters between, so that they have values between 0 and 9. And then we'll constrain all of those values to be, then we'll check that all of those values are distinct. And so that's a separate predicate which I need to define as well. And we'll define a little sort of carry adder in Prolog that we use to add up the lists to check that they add up to the right value. So That is to check that the first two lists add up to the third list in sort of decimal arithmetic. Okay? So this add carry predicate takes two lists and adds them and checks that they add up to the third list, and also this is the carry, which is initially going to be zero. Okay? So then just to flesh this out, here's the distinctness predicate. So if you have the empty list, then every element in the empty list is distinct from every other one. And if you have a non-empty list, so x followed by some other elements, x's, then first we check that x doesn't appear in x's using negation of membership, and then check that x's is a list of distinct things, okay? So hopefully this is, you know, none of this uses things that we haven't seen before, so hopefully that's clear. So now for the carry adder, here's how we can define it. So the simple case is, first of all, there's going to be an invariant that the three lists we're adding up all have the same length, okay? So that'll simplify things. So to accomplish this, I've padded it by sticking in a zero at the beginning. Okay, so next, what we're going to do, so then the base case is if we've got to the end, then the first list and the second list add up to the third list and there's no carry. Okay, then next, if we have lists that start with A and B and then a result that starts with C, first we add the lists, the sublists, and get C's, and we get some carry that results from that addition. And then we can figure out what C is by adding A and B and one if there was a carry left over from the sublists. And then, so C has to be between 0 and 9, so we need to take it modulo 10. And then the carry for the result of this is going to be either 0 or 1. So we can use integer division to find out whether it should be 0 or 1 just by adding these three things that we used to get C and dividing by 10. So this is integer division in Prolog is going to round down. Okay. Great. So let's see how well that works. Okay, so while that runs, let me explain the other solution. So the second approach is going to use these constraints and the labeling predicate that I showed. So first we're going to say, okay, instead of saying S and the other letters are between 0 and 9 by generating them, let's just say that they have to be between 0 and 9, and we'll check later that they really are. Okay, so we're going to just use these in constraints. And then we're going to also use this all different constraint that I showed that abbreviates these, you know, n squared plus n over 2 copies of, or n squared minus n over 2 copies of inequalities between S and E and N and E and so on. Okay, so that's going to force all the letters to have different numeric values. And then instead of using Prolog's built-in arithmetic to add the ground value natural numbers that we're generating, we need to define a different addition predicate that uses constraints. So that'll be on the next slide. But sort of morally, that's doing the same thing as the explicit add carry program that I showed on the previous slide. And then finally, we'll use this labeling predicate to generate solutions. Okay. So let's see if, while I was explaining that, this came back. Yes, it did come back. And so we can find several solutions, two solutions right away. And then if we ask for more solutions, it goes off into hyperspace again and eventually comes back and gives us more. So there's sort of sufficiently complicated search space here that the naive solution is taking a while. So now let me just explain this add carry predicate here. So if you sort of squint your eyes a little bit, really this looks pretty much the same as on the previous slide. And the differences are just that mostly that we're just using this hash equals constraint for equality instead of prolog is to evaluate. Okay, so the base case is the same, and then the inductive case is pretty much the same. We do the recursive call, we get the next carry number, and then we say, okay, well, C had better be equal in any solution to A plus B plus the next carry mod 10, and the next and this carry is going to be A plus B plus next carry divided by 10, again, rounded off. So this is really almost the same except for the use of these constraints. Let me just see if you believe that, you know, this really the only differences here are changing these is predicates that require this to be ground into hash equals predicates that don't require this side to be ground. Okay? So let's see how well that works. Okay. That's not it. That's not good. Solve money. Okay, so we get a solution right away, and actually we can flip through all the solutions pretty quickly. And we can even, I've done it already here, we can even use the find all or other collection forming predicates to find all the solutions and then count how many there are. And that also is very quick. So there are 25 solutions. Okay? All right. So that's a simple but relatively clean example of constraint logic programming with finite domain constraints. And there are other constraint domains that are built into Sixtus that you can use for similar problems, but that might involve, you know, more like numeric or financial computations. So I think, you know, for example, we can using constraint logic programming over the real numbers, for example, we can take, construct sets of equations over the real numbers, over the rational numbers, and find solutions that minimize or maximize. First I need to load the CLP R library, but we can minimize or maximize some values involving real numbers, and let me just demonstrate that this really is talking about real numbers. See if we get different. Well, you know, these are still floating point numbers, right? But this is at least demonstrating the basic idea is not just restricted to finite domain constraints over integers. Okay. And so I showed real numbers there, but we can also solve constraints over rational numbers, restricted to rational numbers. Okay. So that's about all I wanted to say about constraint logic programming today, and I'm going to go through some slides describing review material for the programming part of the course now, unless there are any questions about the material so far today. Nope. Okay, good. Right, well, I just, you know, so these, as I said before, these are provided as built-in libraries in Sixtus Prolog. Oh, and there's one weird thing to watch out for if you want to use do division in Prolog, which is if you're using is, then single slash division does exact division, so that something on the previous slides was lying about this. And double slash does integer division, so the slides should have had double slash on it. But for constraints, single slash will do finite domain integer division, and double slash doesn't give you the right answer. So if you ever need to use this kind of thing, then watch out for that. Okay, so now here's the discussion of the review. So the first half of the course pretty much covered basic material involving logic programming and some intuition for how the interpreter does proof search, and how things like terms and variables and unification work and how they're implemented. So things like the occurs check, whether the behavior of the interpreter with and without the occurs check. So these are things that you might be asked to explain on one of the exams. Similarly, things involving writing programs involve, you need to understand how to write programs involving recursion and avoid sort of non-termination, for example, dealing with writing goals in appropriate, rules and goals in appropriate orders to get the program to terminate. And also programming with more complicated data structures like lists or terms. So for the programming part of the exam, we expect the ability to solve problems similar to, or maybe combining ideas from problems in the tutorial programming exercises or exercises in the textbook. Okay, so then in the second half of the course, we've looked at more applications and programming paradigms within logic programming. So we've seen things like definite clause grammars and difference lists, which are kind of connected formalisms for processing lists or language sentences. And features that aren't really based on logic, such as this evaluation is predicate and the cut and negation, and also knowledge-based manipulation operations like assert and retract. And things like collecting solutions or being able to manipulate the term data structure explicitly. And these are also things that the exams may cover, require the ability to either explain concepts or to use these programs or these ideas in simple prologue programs which you might be asked to construct. We've also covered some advanced topics such as different search techniques, depth-first search and breadth-first search and various permutations and efficient implementation techniques for these. And techniques for symbolic programming or metaprogramming, both involving sort of term manipulation and things like calling, either writing variants of the prologue interpreter that provide different behavior or using predicates like call that let you take a term and call it as if it was a goal. And today we covered constraint logic programming. So these are things where you might be tested on understanding of the basic ideas, not necessarily on the ability to write programs like these from scratch under time pressure, but knowledge, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have paid attention in the last few lectures, I guess is what I'm saying. Okay. Also, just to clarify, I think this information is available elsewhere, but so the way this works is there are two exams, right? There's a theory exam and a programming exam, and the programming exam will be 2 hours, and you'll have access to a standard dice machine with Sixtus Prologue available on it. There won't be the Sixtus documentation PDF, but the exam won't rely on your having memorized the names of all the predicates and so on, just knowing how to use them. And there are currently sample exams from some previous years, maybe not yet last year, on the course webpage. The sample exam from last year should be up at some point, and there are also more exams from previous years on the ITO webpage. The format has changed, I think, as of a year or two ago. So the questions are of a similar level of difficulty, but the format is different. There is just one. In previous years, there was just one big exam, whereas now we have two separate ones. Okay. Okay. So just to conclude today, there's a lot more to logic programming than we've been able to cover in this course, and lots of variations and extensions based on different ideas from logic. And so there are several good books. There's one called The Art of Prologue by Sterling and Shapiro that is well worth reading if you're interested in learning more about logic programming. There are resources online and even a sort of professional research association called the Association for Logic Programming. And there are journals and conferences that meet every year. In fact, I think the last occurrence of the main conference on logic programming met here in Edinburgh this summer. So these are good places to look if you're interested in this kind of work, or if you're interested in doing, say, a research project involving logic programming. All right, great. So that's it. Also, I think there may be a review session possibly organized by Phil next week. I'm not sure. If so, that'll be announced on the course mailing list.
Is there a tutorial tomorrow or?
Yeah, there are tutorials.
This last time, I don't think that the teacher came.
Really? Last Friday.
I went there, but
okay.
Only was for 15 minutes and then.
Okay, that's not good. So last week I switched with Phil.
Okay.
And
I didn't stay the whole
yeah.
hour, so just
there was some mix up with the rooms for the day on Monday when I took Phil's session, so there might have been a mix up.
So
but yeah,
tomorrow.
We'll definitely have tomorrow.